When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Da San Siro il Milan è passato in vantaggio con un colpo di testa di Hatley, perfetto il cross abbastanza teso di Virdis al centro dell'area di rigore. Hatley e ha messo dentro il 2-1 per il Milan. A te la linea.
Durant challenging for it, that breaks to Hatley. Oh, and Hatley has scored a sensational goal for Rangers. 2.5 minutes gone, and Mark Hatley with a mighty shot which gave Lukic no chance whatsoever.
Marseille waiting to make the substitution. Referee allowing play to go on here. Durant to McSwagan. It's Durant again who's onside. Hatley's in the middle. Mark Hatley! 81 minutes gone! Mark Hatley!
Hello Ramblers, Andy here, and an interesting ramble meets for you today that really keys into my childhood actually. Today I'm speaking with Mark Hatley, former centre forward for England, Rangers, Portsmouth, yeah that's for you Lukey, Milan, Monaco under Arsene Wenger, there are so many great tales in here. And not just because he was in Serie A in a fascinating time for the league. He was at Rangers at an absolutely fascinating time as well. A centre forward who had a lot more to him than meets the eye. He's just got a book out called Hitting the Mark. Well worth a read. So many great stories in there. And we'll get into some of them and the stories behind those stories. In this, this is Ramble Meets Mark Hatley. So thanks for joining us, Mark. I've read the book. I've enjoyed the book. What sort of experience was it for you writing the book? I mean, it's been a while since you retired. So was everything from your life and career already clear in your head? Or did you, do you think, learn some stuff about yourself when you were putting it all down there and talking about it all over again?
No, I think it's refueled a lot of long lost memories, to tell you the truth. Alistair, the writer, who I've nicknamed Sherlock, has found some incredible information from way back. I mean, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, all them, you know, the school years that you can seldom remember. You sort of left them there, you've moved forward into your teens, then you leave them and then you go into your, you know, to the beginning of a career. So there's a lot of that has been refound, rediscovered, which has been really good for me. Because you know, I'm one of these guys that completely parks at the past. I don't look into the past. I don't look at old games. Never have looked at old games, and always sort of living right in the moment, sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's been really, really good.
Do you think more players are likely to be like that now? I mean, in the environment we're in, it feels like there's so much football, and particularly I guess in the last year and a half post pandemic, the timetable, we've been playing catch up for a lot of time. I mean, I do wonder when players get the ability to, or get the time really to reflect on their performances and reflect on where they are.
Yeah, well, I think you reflect straight away. I mean, as you're walking off the pitch, we didn't have, when I was playing, you didn't have the analysis and all that sort of stuff and the data, you know, fed to you. I think it was down to the individual. You know, as you've read the book, and I don't think there's been a bad word from any manager that's had me. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Because my process has always been to analyse what I have done and what the team have done. You know, it's down to me to make it right. And then I think, you know, Graham Souness and Arsene Wenger's and of this world, Bobby Robson's, you know, they didn't need to speak to you, you know, because, you know, I am processing everything as the game finishes straight away. It's all down to the individual, as you say, in this time of many games, you know, lots of games coming fast and furious, a lot of international games as well. It's down to that, the individual process. I think you can supply people with as much of information as they want of stats for a game, but at the end of the day, you've got to be able to handle it yourself within your own head. A lot of people can, you know, can fire things at you, but deep down, it's the individual that makes the individual, not a team that's around you.
You talk a lot, particularly in the early stages of the book, about your father, Tony, who was a great player in his own right. Of course, it's gone on a generation. Your son Tom has had a very successful career, and he was very much born into it. I mean, he was born in Monte Carlo when you were out playing for Monaco. Played in Scotland before doing very, very well in Poland with a couple of clubs. What did you look at in your relationship between you and your dad when you were coming through in terms of helping him when he was starting in the professional game? Did you approach it differently?
Yeah, completely differently. I allowed Tom to have his own head. Didn't push him, didn't force him. Tell a lie, I made him play left wing for Ascot United when he was about 8. Yeah, for 1 year. Yeah. I spoke with a coach who's a good friend of mine. down there, and I said, I want him to, his left foot, he didn't have a left foot.
Right.
So I wanted, and I said, can you do me a favour? Can you play him out on the left, right? And every time he cuts in on his right, right, I want you to take him off. Okay? Yeah, and that was the only thing I did. And to this day, Tom always thanks me. He hated it, but, you know, his left foot is as good as his right foot. So it works. It works at that age. And then after that, it's a journey of discovery of where you want to play. He started at a number nine. He started as a centre forward, I think the Chelsea boys. Really didn't fancy that. I thought it was a good move for him because of his ability. He's a completely different player to me, you know, sort of different stature. He's 6 foot, but he's a real strong, thick-set lad. He has an ability to... He has a great understanding of the game. Far better than me when I started out, of appreciation of different positions. Because of obviously the back then the kids played all sorts of positions at school. You know, they just moved them around all over town, which is a great thing to be able to do. But it was a failing for him, I think, when he first came into the game at Motherwell, because he came as a central midfield player, and it's the story because he signed on a Friday after leaving Reading, and. The right back got injured in the warm up, so Tom was on the bench because he just signed on the Friday. And the manager said to him, "Can you play right back?" He said, "I can play right back, centre half, central mid. I can play left back if you want me to." So he went and played right back, and he played that well. They kept him there. So the only time he could get to go and play in his position as a holding midfield player was for Old Firm games, where he did exceptionally well, scored a fantastic goal against Rangers, which was a bit, oh, shall I stand up and applaud or shall I just sit down? it was one of them moments. But I think that was probably one of his downfall. He should never have played so well at right back. Because he has that mind, you know.
So it's clear that he's stepped out of his dad's shadow. You talked about stepping out of yours. Stepping out of Tony's. So was the moment when you decided to leave Coventry and go to Portsmouth and step down a division the moment that you really did that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's where we came sort of two stags butting heads, if you wanted to call it that way, because I didn't speak to my dad for about 7 months, 8 months after I moved down a league. But it was Chelsea and I think Chelsea and Watford were hovering around me at that period of time as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Bobby Campbell, ex-Chelsea manager, into Portsmouth, bringing them through the leagues. Met with him, and the first time I met with him, because don't forget, I was in and out of the Coventry side, playing left wing, centre forward sometimes, and I was behind Mick Ferguson and Big Gary Thompson. So I was never be that as I wanted to be, a number nine straight away. And Bobby Campbell just said to me, he said, "I want you to be my my centre forward," and that sold it to me straight away. And from day one, I had a nine on my back. Scored against Fulham at Craven Cottage in the first game, far post header at the far post. Classic. Dad had been proud, but we weren't talking because I'd gone down a league, and he said he would never move down a league because it's very, very difficult to get yourself back up into the top flight. Always stay at the top flight as long as you can. It's the best place to be. But I had it in myself to, you know, go and prove to myself I wanted to be that number nine. I could be a number nine. And, you know, as I say, the rest is history. I went down to the second division and ended up scoring a winner in an under 21 European final against Spain in that year. Ended up with 24 goals in 32 league games for Portsmouth, player of the year, golden player of the year, the golden player in that under 21 tournament. And then went to play for England, all within that year where my dad said I should never go down a league. So that's, you know, started talking to him after that. And, you know, we were back on course.
So It's like you were sort of hinting at there, it was quite dizzying from going down a division to all of a sudden England, eventually Milan. We'll come back to Milan in a minute, but what about the England bit? Because everyone thinks of the Maracanã in 84 and everyone thinks of that John Barnes goal, which you're claiming an assist for, aren't you?
Of course I am. If you see that goal, go and Google it. I catch the ball on my chest. The boy Moser is marking me quite tight, and I catch the ball on my chest, I bring the ball down and I spray it out to the left side, and I'm the last. If that's not an assist, it was the last person to give him the ball before he scored, so that must be an assist, is it not?
But it is certainly by today's standards. Get you some points in fantasy league, there's no doubt about
it. Absolutely.
But you scored yourself as well. And then it's quite unusual the way you tell the story about how the move to Milan comes about, because it's your international teammate, Ray Wilkins, who approaches you in the first instance.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, the goal was a traditional header at the far post, nothing special. John Barnes hung it up. So, you know, and I said, I'll give him an assist for mine as well. Set us all both off on different sort of paths, but on a successful path. Yeah, Ray came in, knocked on the door, and came into the room. I was lying on the bed, ready to go for training, and he just said, "I've had Milan on the phone." Obviously, Ray had signed for Milan like on a pre-contract in Easter from Manchester United, so he was the deal was signed and sealed for him. He was looking forward to going on from after the trip to South America. So he just said, "Yeah, I've had Milan on the phone, and they would you fancy coming?" And I thought he was a wind up, you know, this naive young centre forward, still got 2 years to go on a Portsmouth contract, all that blah blah blah. Blah. Anyway, he said, "I said you're having a laugh, aren't you?" I said, and he said, "No, Dad. Deadly serious. I've had the sporting director, president's been on the phone to me. I've got the managers on the phone to me." So I said, "All right, I'll leave it. I said, "I don't think so. I think Portsmouth will want to keep me, being that young, naive, you know, young man that I was back then, 2 years to go and taking the team forward." And then literally I got on with training. The next 2 or 3 days went by, and he came in and he just said, "Well, the deal's been done. You know, I think Milan are playing a £1.45 million for you," which was a lot of money back then.
So had you not heard from them by this point? Is this just all from Ray?
All from Ray. I had no contact at all. Said the deal. Right. I said, "Well, the deal hasn't been done because I haven't spoke to anybody." He said, "Well, the deal's been done between the clubs. I think you'll find that you'll be flying home probably in the next couple of days and you'll miss the end of it," sort of stuff. The end of the trip. And it was right, you know. I was on a plane. Bobby came to me and he just said, "Yeah, you need to fly back. You, great move for you. Great league. And good luck doing your deal." So I just flew back straight in. Literally, there was a big house near Heathrow Airport, and myself and my agent, Dennis Roach, who was basically the super agent of the time, sat in a room and just went from room to room to room, sporting director, president, all doing the deal, my personal deal. And it was sorted by the end of the day. And, you know, the next thing I'm being introduced as a Milan player.
I mean, how does that feel at the time? Because you have gone from the second tier via, obviously, some great moments with England, but you're still quite a young player. And at this point, it's worth underlining that Serie A had a ton of superstars and quite a few British players as well.
Yeah, Graham was there, Graham Souness, Trevor Francis, Liam Brady, all enjoying, you know, good careers out there. I think Graham, obviously, from his Liverpool days to Sampdoria, playing, you know, with the likes of Mancini and Vialli. You know, everybody was playing there. Rummenigge, Zico, Platini, you know, Maradona joined me the same year as I went there, sort of stuff. So it was the league to play. You know, you'd seen a little bit on Channel 4. We used to watch Channel 4 and get the highlights of the Italian league. But as I said, going forward, I always wanted to be a better player than my dad. I saw a little bit of South American football, obviously when the World Cups were on in 70 and what have you. And I thought, well, I like that sort of style of football. Mm. You know, and European football probably was the way forward. So I was fortunate to get the move, but I always wanted to be and embrace a different sort of culture of the game. I was quite the British centre forward, if you want, but I thought I had a lot more to me to be able to do better than just a British centre forward, and Italy and AC Milan. It was the perfect time for me at AC Milan. It was because AC Milan obviously had gone down the leagues and they were rebuilding with a young side, you know, young Tassotti, young Baresi, 16-year-old Maldini that came in the second year. You had Massaro's, Donadoni's, and I had the experience of playing with Paolo Rossi for a year. And Paolo Verdes, who was an experienced player, and it was all good for me, you know. It was as I say, it got me a different culture, a different place to go and learn, and literally going. It was like going to a university as a young man, and you know, growing from there, as they say.
But before we talk more about Milan, I have to ask, how was it seeing the Maradona phenomenon at first hand? Because, of course, as you say, you arrived in Italy at the same time as him, at which point Napoli have never won anything ever, and he transforms them, and I think they win their first title in what, but probably your last season in Serie A.
Yeah, it was the last season. So it took him 3 years to establish them. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, you know what I mean. I think Verona was the club that won the title.
Yeah,
in the
85. Yeah,
and. So yeah, it was don't get me wrong. I just saw a great player, but you see great players. I was fortunate enough to meet my greatest idol in Zico in my first game in a pre-season game against Udinese, you know. Right. So all of a sudden you've met your idol, wasn't disappointed, got his shirt, and you know,
good.
I'd complete focus on what I was trying to do, so I was not, you know, overawed by anybody, really. You know, it sounds arrogant, but I think confident is the word. You know, I'm playing up against Claudio Gentile, probably one of the hardest centre halves in man markers in world football at the time. Mm. You know, kick lumps out of you. But yeah, you know, I just went straight back at him and did exactly the same thing he was doing to me. And then, you know, just run him round the pitch a bit more, you know, as centre-halves didn't like being done back in the day.
But I guess when we're talking about, you know, you doing the book and looking back, do you have that moment that thinks, well, I was playing with Maradona at this moment? Because it's not just that you were in the league when he won the league with Napoli for the first time. You were on the bench in that World Cup quarterfinal as well. So you've seen two of the biggest Maradona moments, I guess, firsthand in a way that very few people have.
Yeah, absolutely. And the pressures that the man came under, you know, he was carrying a whole, not a city, he was carrying literally the whole of southern Italy, you know, to... as his cause, and it was the perfect place for him to be. Probably if he was to be like Inter Milan or Milan or Juventus, that probably would not have been the right place for him. So he actually found his place, his comfort, and that's the sort of performances that you get from a man when they're completely at home in their environment.
Now, you talked about it being a football university for you in Italy. How big a part of this? Because, of course, this is pre-Arrigo Sacchi, Milan. How important was Nils Lidholm, who was your coach at the time, and one of the greatest strikers in Italian football history? What did he do for you?
Absolutely. He was he was remarkable. He had so much time, for me personally, you know. He, as I say, took me for walks round. We finished training, we walked round the pitch, walked through the woods up at Milanello, talking about life and what we wanted for life, and his career and how he went and his mistakes and you know, the pitfalls of being, you know, that superstar, if you want. He'd been to a cup final, obviously 58 cup final, scored in a cup final on the losing side, Pelé being the man, you know, so he'd had all those experiences, and it wasn't his first time at Milan, so he knew how Milan worked. But he had a lot of time for me. He took me, you know, to one-on-one training with a goalkeeper on a many, many occasions with a bag of balls and a load of cones, and just walk through situations. Nothing intense, just walk through situations where, you know, we don't want you to tackle fullbacks right now. As a British centre forward would do, he would come out and try and tackle the fullback. He said, because, you know, you're learning, I was learning a completely different game. He said, because if you go out to the left side, that means that our left-sided midfield player can't engage high up the pitch. And if he doesn't engage high up the pitch, that means that our left back won't come high up the pitch. So we were talking about a pressing game back in the mid-80s of a guy that was completely ahead of the game. And that's where Sacchi came in afterwards to continue that high-pressing, high-intense game. You know, it was a great experience of receiving the ball when the left back had the ball, where I should be, where a central midfield player working within the width of the penalty area, where I always used to think, I used to look at European strikers and think, wow, what a lazy git he is, you know. He gives up working outside the penalty box. But it's right. So he was learning the high pressing game back there, 21, 22 years old, you know, with a great man in Niels Leedholm. He was superb for me. I was very intense, high energy, and he was completely the opposite to me. He was typically Swedish, laid back, very calm, very tranquil, and brought that air of tranquility into a young, vibrant dressing room.
How much did scoring the winner against Inter in the derby change your life, do you think?
Oh, just a wee tinsy-wincy bit, sort of stuff. Yeah, I mean, I get sent off in my first game, so in Coppa Italia, just headbutt, a flying, it was a big guy, a brute of a guy that was kicking and punching me, and I just got up off the floor and right on, then on the forehead. That endeared me as much as the goal to the Milan fans. Right. And I think when you are a foreigner playing at a big club in a strange land, should we say, you know, all of a sudden you've got the cut of Osud, the ultras, all willing you to do well. And that in itself is a remarkable thing to be able to, and that's one game into it. I mean, the physical side of the game, you know, those sort of fans, the ultra fans, they love all that sort of stuff. And once you've got the ultras with you, the big fans with you, then they're just, you know, they're willing you to do well all the time. Even if you're not doing that well, do you know what I mean? You're still getting that love from them. So five games in. Yeah, it couldn't have been a better story. You know, playing against Colavarti, ex Milan captain, jumped ship to Inter, the biggest rivals, and that day I was up against him. And you know, to score the winning goal against the ex captain who jumped ship and left Milan in a mess, then it doesn't get any better. You know, I went over a couple of years ago to the Ultras 50th year anniversary, and they still got you there and they treat you like a god.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
So you talked about how you've been sort of typecast as a typical British blood and thunder centre forward, but you always had that bit more to your game. It's something that players who played with you say a lot, that there was more to your game. There was the pace, there was intelligence. So you stayed out in continental Europe once you left Milan. How important was Arsene Wenger in convincing you to go to Monaco?
Yeah. Well, Arsene had just come to the side. He'd been managing at a lower league. I'm guessing on that one, but he wasn't in the highest league. And it was a great move for him, a visionary move for Monaco to bring him. And as I say, Graham Souness was trying to get me to go to Glasgow Rangers at that particular time when I was leaving. Roma wanted me. Verona wanted me to stay in Italy, but my heart was never going to be in another Italian club. And my relationship with the supporters. So, I think the ideal thing, and especially for Berlusconi, was for me to leave Italy. Didn't want him to come and bite him on the backside again, playing for another Italian side. So, Mr. Berlusconi, he basically made it very easy for me to leave Italy, for a big, a well-reduced fee, which, fitted Arsene Wenger. I was his first signing. I went in and, wanted to have that different culture again. It was a completely different culture for me as well, because in Milan, I couldn't go out anywhere. It was mobbed everywhere I went. It was quite frightening at times with the family. So it was, Milanello, San Siro, home, private hotel for a meal with the family, and that was about it. Couldn't go shopping, couldn't do any of the normal stuff as you did as a family. So French football and Monaco was, the ideal environment for me to go and learn a different culture. You've got Ayrton Senna living in the floor below me. You've got Boris Becker living in the next building. You've got this person, they got that person. And, you're hooking up and making friends within the family. The Grimaldi family. Prince Albert, I would say, is still a good friend. Same age, knocked around together, while we're there. Loved his sport. Loved the players that his football club. And was always willing to be able to do that. My kids used to be pushed around, Princess Caroline with her kids, and in the park, and it was a completely different environment, and one where you could relax, and then push yourself within the side that Arsene had come into, because Arsene had joined a really, really good side anyway. Amaros, Batiston, Luke Sonno, Jean-Philippe Roy, Patrick Meij, all international players under 21s and full team, obviously, with Patrick Batiston being the main man there as the centre half. He took that on, as you would expect, as a real young man. I think he was only about 34, 35 when he came to Monaco, and was able to handle big personalities and big stars. You know, he was very, very intelligent, and as I say, he actually came to me after about 10 days being there, and he said, "We're desperately trying to get a number 10 to come and play with you. And we can't find anybody at the moment." I said, "Well, you know, why don't you go and get Glenn Hoddle?" He said, "Well, he's signed for PSG." I said, he's not signed for PSG. He said, "He's signed for PSG." He said, because obviously Arsene had all the contacts into all the clubs. And I said, "I can assure you he hasn't signed, because his agent is my agent. He's supposed to be flying in tomorrow to sign the papers and all that sort of stuff." And I said, here's the contact number." So he phoned, he phoned the agent up, who passed the message on to Glenn, who obviously I knew from the England days, and you know, he landed in Paris, jumped straight on a plane to Monaco, came down, they picked him up, sat all day discussing a deal, and the deal was done by the end of the day, and he was the number 10 that was going to come and play in our team, and you know, and the rest, as I say, is history. We went on and had a great season that year, scored plenty of goals, and we went on to win the title, and you know, at my age, 24, 25 years old, it was, you know, it was always what you set off in life to do as a professional footballer, is to win things. Went to a cup final that year. We didn't win, but we had a great night afterwards in Paris with the Grimaldi family. Big food fight and all that sort of stuff. And this top restaurant started by Prince Albert, I must admit. But you know, that's the sort of environment I was now in. It was a great place to be. Different culture, different way of playing the game, and working with. You know, a guy that was to bring football into, you know, the 20th century, 21st century, if you want, with remarkable different training regimes.
On Wenger, a lot of people, when he signed for Arsenal in the mid-90s, were a bit, who is this guy? Did you have faith that it would work straight away?
I did. The Sunday newspapers phoned me as soon as he saw it was on his way. I mean, the man, he goes from Monaco to Japan just to study a different way of life, different customs. Who is this man coming in, you know? And I said, sit down and enjoy. I said, this guy will bring Arsenal success like they've never seen. He will literally transform it. You can look back on press cuttings and what have you. And I said, he will transform him with his methods. If people don't buy in, then they'll be gone and new people will come in, but he will transform and then they'll be a different club. And that's what happened.
So it proved.
Yeah.
So you speak about Monaco as if it was pretty idyllic, and it is. I mean, I always thought when you go up to the training ground at La Turbie and you take these sort of windy roads up the rock, it's very sort of reminiscent of the Italian job, isn't it? It must have been a beautiful place to work every single day as you look down over the Med. I saw Glenn Hoddle a couple of weeks ago, and he said you gave him a lift to training once and he didn't care much for your driving.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, this is what we are. Footballers always want to be Formula One racing drivers, and Formula One racing drivers always want to be footballers. So, you know, I had back, you know, obviously a young man and what have you, a passion for fast cars. You know, I had a Porsche 911 turbo convertible, and I used to drive it like a 911. Turbo convertible. You know, that's what they're for. They're a driving car. And I said, come in and we put some music on, turned it up, and up we went. And when by the time I got up there, Glenn's face was white as a sheet. He didn't enjoy it. But that's the difference in us. That used to real build me up for a training session. It was the same going to a game. You know, if I was driving, I would always have music on loud, and you know, I would drive the car there. You know, I wouldn't saunter to a game, and that's just the way I am. I'll tell you a true story. When I was at Rangers, Walter Smith came up to me on one Friday, and he just said, it's a hard thing to say as a manager, but I don't want you to train on a Friday, right? You're in game mode, and I used to train absolutely crazy. On a Friday, I'd be competitive, over competitive. Anything, I'd snap very quickly. And he said, "It's best for you if you just come in, you know, have a little jog, have a massage, have the food, and go home and do what you do. It'll be best." And that's how I was from a Thursday onwards until a game on the Saturday, probably winding down on a Sunday. And then back up preparing for a Monday. So driving a car the way I did, and you know, getting that adrenaline flying through your system was my method.
So to quote Ian Durant in your book, why did you leave this? Because you've got this beautiful life, and also the other side of going to Rangers is by this point you've started to pick up a few injuries, and it's been hard work to get back. I mean, I think you injured yourself catching your foot in the pitch at some point, didn't you?
Yeah, divot in the European. It was in Galatasaray. I think it was in the March. It was quarterfinals. 10 minutes goes. We come off. We walk off. We go into the dressing room and into the ante room where the treatment was. And Wenger came in, and Michel, the physio, he sat me down, took my boot off, all that sort of stuff, and then cut the strapping off. And as my foot was like that on an angle, it just fell all the way around, and it was completely gone. And as I say, that was an injury. Probably I hadn't had a break for, I'm going to say, 2 or 3 seasons, because I was playing through the summer on internationals, the under 21s, the England stuff, the Euros 88, and that's what it was after, straight on the back of non-stop football. I'm going to say 18 months, 2 years of non-stop start operations, 4 operations over that period, which didn't allow me to really play any football apart from that first season where we won the league. But the incredible thing about that story is that then Milan gave me a new 5-year contract, which was, you know, a crazy thing. It was a letter pushed underneath my door. Handwritten. I thought it was a joke. I went to see Glenn because I thought he'd done it. He was living just a couple of floors below me. I said, "Have you written this?" He said, "No, but I wish I was getting that contract." So that was the faith that Wenger and the club had in me to be able to come back, and strength of mind, and you know, that fortitude that you carry with you to be a better player than I did. So it was, yeah, it was. Took the edge off it, but it's nothing. It was, as you read in the book, it was a dark 8 months for me in between all that sort of stuff.
So it's not just the leaving the Monaco on a personal level, on a lifestyle level, but people would say if you've had a lot of injuries, you're not really going to be spared by defenders by going to Scotland. So what convinced you? Was it Graham? Was it a sense that you wanted to be back in Britain? Which of those things was it? Or a combination?
It was a combination. I always wanted to go back to Britain, England, Britain, and, you know, provide the finished article, which I set out to do in the first place. You know, England gave me the chance to set it all up. I went away, made myself a better player, a better person. And I was more or less the finished article, more or less. And then the opportunity to go and play for Graham, because I know Graham right through my career. We were still very good friends to the day. Just by sheer accident, I was walking with the kids through Casino Square, and we bumped into each other again. And, you know, that immortal line, I know your situation, you fancy coming to play for us. I said all that sort of stuff. I went through that whole story, long story short, new contract, blah de blah de blah. I'm not sure what the club would want, but, you know. Anyway, I went away, thought about it, slept on it. I still was unsure. Went to see Wenger. And Wenger was great with me. He said, listen, we've given you the new contract. We know you'll be back stronger. Physically, I was far stronger than I was before the injury anyway. I just wasn't match worthy or match ready. Hence the fact that Bobby left me out that 90 squad to go and play in Italy, because he wanted me to have a dozen games under my belt before he would pick me. So he just said, listen, we've brought a young boy in George Weah, who we want you to play with next year. Next season, get Glenn fit again, all that sort of stuff, and you know, more or less the same team. So we have every faith. But he said, I do understand. He said, you know, through injuries, and he went on his career, because his career got cut short with a big injury, and probably a change of atmosphere, a change of direction. Might just be the thing you're looking for, but whatever you decide, you know, our club and everybody here, you know, is right behind you. So I went away and slept on it again, and I woke up and just said, yeah, right. Went to see Graham, said I'm ready to go, and literally that was it. I signed, did the deal. Probably one. I was probably one fifth of what I was earning, but never driven by that sort of financial gains. I've never been driven by that in football. And it was a chance to, you know, to go and, you know, develop another side of my game, which I did quite successfully. And I think between the age of 32 and probably 34, I was probably playing the best football that I'd ever played. In my head, in my body.
So, we talked about Serie A being a different kettle of fish when you arrived there. You could say the same for Rangers. I mean, they could. This was before the Premier League had really taken off. I mean, that's 92, isn't it? So you're a bit into your spell by Rangers by that point. At this point, Rangers are still in Europe. They can outbid English clubs for players. You look at some of the names who go up there, yourself included. I mean, this must have been an incredibly exciting time to be there, and particularly as in that first year of the Champions League, when the European Cup comes, the Champions League, 92-93, you're so close to making it to the final instead of Marseille.
Yeah, well, we should have done. I said to Walter when the group stages were drawn, that I could see us going all the way to the final, because we were good enough. We were unbeatable at home. We couldn't lose at home. And our team was, as we proved against Leeds, we could defend. Great goalkeeper, great back four. Terrific midfield, and two guys that would score goals for fun.
And talking of that tie with Leeds, tell us a bit about the atmosphere around that, because I remember as a kid that being absolutely
huge.
Yeah. Like the champions of England versus the champions of Scotland in the Champions League.
We won the first game 2-1, got completely pulverised by the press, British press, and some of the Scottish press as well, because you know how that works up here anyway. You know, you've got the haters and the likers. Leeds will completely do the job once you get down to Ellen Road. So it was a master stroke by Walter Smith and Archie Knox. All they did, we never had a meeting, which was really strange. We normally have a couple of meetings of the day of the game. Didn't happen. We didn't have a meet. Well, we normally get off the bus straight into the dressing room, drop the shower bag off, and go onto the pitch. was told to go straight onto the pitch. But by the time we got from the pitch to the dressing room, every headline from every newspaper you could imagine was just stuck on the wall, all around the dressing room. No, absolutely. No team talk. No team talk. Well, we just come in and last minute, and he just said, you know what you got to do today? Let's go and do it. And that was it. That was the team talk. Simple as that. Brilliant man, I must say.
Is Rangers still the pinnacle for you then?
I think
of your career.
I had to adjust my game a lot to play back here. First and foremost, when I came to Scotland, I was 12'3" coming from Monaco. I realised immediately I needed to be stronger and I needed to be heavier. So I took my weight in muscle weight up to 13'10" in about 2 months, which became that's the weight I am right about now. Obviously, a little bit fatter, less muscle, but that was my transformation, and that 13'10" gave me the power and more pace and more strength to dominate at that level, and also on the European stage as well. And that's why when I was playing that well and scoring lots of goals, Alistair was picking up European boots back to back. You know, we were winning titles, we were winning this, that and the other. I was really surprised that, England didn't come calling again. But on the upside to that, that probably kept me fresher for the longevity that I had at in the game.
So, post-career, you have your player-manager experience with Hull, which doesn't quite work for one reason or another. Then post-career, when you go into punditry and what have you, and journalism, and then Rangers have their difficult period, let's say, where everything goes wrong. And when guys like Dave King and Paul Murray come to the point where they want to take the reins of the club, they come to you to make that connection again with the old players and make that connection with the supporters. How does that work, and what has that done for your relationship with Rangers, which was obviously already very strong?
Yeah, my relationship with Rangers, the football club, will never change. You know, I'll always be a loyal Rangers supporter from the year 2000, the turn of the century, up to a couple of years ago. I was an ambassador for the football club in more ways than one, working in the background, trying to keep the from the high times to the low times, trying to keep it on a level that I thought was a respectable part to be doing. The relationship with the fans, also the other side of the community side of it that we which Rangers Football Club is all about for me. And then under Dave King, which I've known Dave for a long, long time, known Paul Murray and John Gilligan, the three guys that saved the club, Dave came to me and he just said, I'd like you to be more than what you're doing right now. I'd like to bring you in full time and, be like a development, business development man for me, which, I had a good business background I had a business when I was playing as well, and I've got that sort of brain that it works that way sort of stuff. I said, yeah, sure, I'll come in, do that sort of stuff. And, but did some really good stuff, got up and forged a really good working relationship with the football side of the football club, and also the business side of the club, the commercial side. I had visions, and I'd had an insight into big clubs all over, how they were run. With Mark Allen, the sporting director, I was sort of the bridge between commercial and the football side of it, which probably invariably them two never sort of marry very well in the football world.
And so it also means you're on the scene at the club when Steven Gerrard comes in and starts taking Rangers on. Now it's over. How do you assess Gerrard at Rangers?
Steven was brilliant. Ticked a lot of boxes. I think the only disappointment was probably the cup competitions, where Steven made a name for himself in cup competitions. But I think he ticked... the remit was to stop Celtic win 10 in a row. It was to win a title. It was to get title 55 for the club. And he did that in spades, and he bought that his brand within the Rangers brand, which on a marketing and I'm going to say marketing and commercial side is a win-win on development and bringing funds into the club. Everybody wants to be associated with Steven in business, and for sponsors to be able to do that, it makes, I think, the commercial side and commercial director's side very much easier, should I say, with me working between the lines sort of stuff.
And finally, firstly, thank you. You've been so generous with your time, Mark. Having gone through the whole story in the last year or so, is there anything you would change?
No. My dad always said, right from the start, be honest with yourself and be honest with others. I think football is a precarious business to be in, but if you can go to bed at night and your family still love you at the end of the day, that's all you're bothered about. And I've always been forthright. I think that's why I get on with certain people like Dave King, Graham Souness. They're forthright. They're up front. There's no grey areas. And that's how I am. Sometimes it can get you probably in trouble, but as I say, you're true to yourself. And that's how I've always tried to be with myself, you know.
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.